Hey, Real Talkers, you've probably seen the clip by now. The official opposition leader, Pierre Poilievre, kicked out of the House of Commons for calling Justin Trudeau a wacko PM. Did he deserve to get the boot? How much responsibility should the Prime Minister take for the tone of politics this week and maybe just every week? Should Greg Fergus, Speaker of the House, resign like the Conservatives want him to do? We get into gamesmanship, theater, communication strategy in this episode of Real Talk. Plus, we touch on that very short-lived plan from the Alberta government to defund public transit supports for seniors and low-income Albertans. They announced that they were walking that move back shortly after our May 1st episode where we talked about it. Not saying, just saying. But the bigger question is, who thought that was a good idea in the first place? We touch on that in just a few moments. Oh, and you are going to hear me reference in this podcast Palestinian peace activist Hamza Hawidi. Was supposed to join us. We're not sure what happened. We're going to try to get him back because he's got a powerful story to share. Let's get into it.
This is a Relay Project. Real Talk starts right now. Here's Ryan Jesperson.
This is going to be one of those episodes of Real Talk. Welcome to the show, everybody, where we're hopping around. We're covering a lot of ground. We're going to be taking a look at stories that are making news, that are impacting people right here in our own backyard, so to speak, in our home province, in our home country, and around the world, for that matter. Hamza Hawidi is going to join us, Palestinian peace activist. He'll be checking in live from Germany, originally from Gaza. He's got a piece in Newsweek that's getting a lot of attention. He did an interview on CNN that a lot of people are talking about, a message from a Gazan to campus protesters. He says, "You're hurting the Palestinian cause." Now, before you jump to conclusions about what Hamza's perspective might be or what motivated his piece, let's talk it out. Let's get into it with him, because, of course, he wants to see peace in his homeland. He wants to see peace for his people. So what does he think is hurting the cause? We'll get into that. This amid, as we're talking to you, a police raid at UCLA on the campus there, a pro-Palestinian demonstration. Police raided Columbia University the other day. Classes are canceled there. Columbia, one of the preeminent journalism schools in North America. And threats of arrest of journalism students as they've been observing what's going on. There are campuses being occupied across Canada. We wanted to get into this. And of course, we know that our conversation with Hamza today will prompt, I'm sure, a response from Real Talkers who want their perspectives represented, who maybe have a different angle on this or might be able to share with us a personal story about why they're getting involved or why they feel the way they do. That's kind of the whole point of this exercise. Now, in our previous episode, in the May 1st episode, when we talked to Charles Adler, we talked about matters of Canadian politics as well, in particular in Alberta. As the provincial government, Danielle Smith's United Conservatives, moved to defund the provincial contribution to a public transit pilot that was designed to make public transit more accessible, mostly financially, for seniors and for low-income Albertans. It was approximately, as we told you about yesterday, about $6 million down in Calgary, about $6 million in Edmonton. The province essentially saying, well, the big cities can pick up their share on this. Transit, public transit, is a municipal initiative. It's a municipal file, so to speak. So this is the job of the cities to figure this out. Well, the backlash, and I'm not saying it was just because of our conversation on Real Talk, but the backlash on this was swift and strong. And after we released our episode, the United Conservatives walking back that plan. The Minister for Seniors, Jason Nixon, saying, "I didn't even know about this." He says this was a cost-measured move by my staff. As we talked about yesterday, peanuts, a pittance. $7 million here, $6 million there in the grand scheme of the provincial budget. And I'm not pretending like millions of dollars don't matter. But in the grand scheme, it's nothing, right? Which made it all the more curious, all the much more mind-boggling that the government was going to walk away from this, because the political points you might attempt to score with whom, by the way, defunding the poor, not exactly the right move, not worth it, right? And the cost savings, really, compared to the public backlash, again, not worth it. So probably nobody's surprised to see the government walk that back. Whether or not you believe that this was something that was simply off the radar of the minister, something that he had no idea about, or whether you believe that maybe they had a quick crisis comms call or a quick, as they call it, issue management call and decided that maybe this wasn't worth the 12 or 13 million bucks in savings, that maybe it was better to make sure that single moms and dads and seniors on fixed income still had access to, you know, the glamour of public transit. My guess is it's probably the latter. We've got a couple of emails here from Real Talkers that wrote in, a whole bunch of you did, and we'd probably be doing a whole show on this. We spent time talking about it yesterday with Chuck and reading your comments, but had this not been walked back, it would be a bigger deal. But it's still a story, even if it was. And so that's why we're going to talk it out with you today. I'm going to get to those emails in just a moment. Plus, drama in Ottawa. I know you'll never believe it, but Justin Trudeau and Pierre Poilievre added in the House of Commons. It winds up the official opposition leader booted, kicked out by the Speaker. Now calls from Conservatives for the Speaker to resign. He says he's not going anywhere. You know, Real Talk's got you covered, so we're going to bring you the audio. I hate to call it, Johnny, entertaining audio,
okay,
because a lot of people believe that the theater in question period and the theater that we see provincially and federally in politics is what's wrong with it. That's what people are saying they don't want to see in city halls, for example.
I agree.
As we introduce political parties at the municipal level in Alberta, that because of that Bill 20 we've been talking about. But I got to be honest, some of the stuff I love. I love some of the back and forth because it gives us clues and hints on what the top political attack points are going to be. We see how capable the leaders and cabinet ministers and senior critics are going to be. Yesterday, the speaker deemed this to have gone too far. A lot of people in Poilievre's camp, though, are going, well, what's the difference between what the prime minister is saying about Pierre Poilievre, basically that he's mingling and rubbing shoulders with extremists, and what Poilievre says, which is, as you're going to hear, calling the PM a wacko house.
We know these days it's all about zingers and bombs. And it's funny because yesterday I was editing, you know, the show after, and I heard, you know, some Poilievre audio come up on your phone. And the first thing I heard was you go, oh, man. And I knew we were going to play this clip today.
Yeah, you don't hear. I can't think of the last time that an official opposition leader or anyone for that matter was calling anybody else a wacko in the house. Whether or not Poilievre should have been kicked out, I'm curious to see where our audience will land on this.
Yeah,
so we've got a lot of ground to cover. We've got some great emails as well. And I was going to say if we've got time, but we'll just make time for it. We've got a couple of great emails from an interview that we did. And this was a while ago with Andrea Hines. You remember this interview? Formerly sold sex. She owned a brothel in Edmonton. And she talked to us back in March. And Andrea, an interesting take with her new book. She's essentially a sex trade abolitionist now. She has really come to an interesting point in her life based on her lived experience and her expertise. And this is an interview that I know got a lot of you thinking. And so Ian and Cheryl both wrote in pretty meaningful emails on that. We've been hanging on to those, looking for an episode. This is that episode. And so we're going to revisit that Andrea Hines interview before we say goodbye today. Let me tell you that this episode of Real Talk simply would not be happening without the support of our presenting sponsor, and that is our friends at Rello right now. They are Alberta's top real estate school, and more Canadians and Albertans in particular are going to Rello because they've made it easy for you to get your real estate career started. We know that you're seeing everybody, all of your friends that are working in real estate, the people in your community, and they're setting their own hours, they're working for themselves. You understand that there's really no income ceiling for them, there's unlimited earning potential, so no wonder everybody wants to get into the business. But how do you make sure you're going to succeed? Well, you got to learn from the industry leading instructors, and that's what you'll find at Rello.ca. That's R-E-L-O.ca. There's a great benefit right now, a great initiative from our friends at Rello who are going to get you set up to get your certification, to write that exam, and to kickstart your career, to actually get the ball rolling. If you use the promo code Ryan100, that's Ryan100, they're going to knock $100 off both the Alberta Residential Real Estate Bundle and the Alberta Commercial Real Estate Bundle. That's Ryan100 when you get started at Rello.ca. You and I called it, I think, after the show yesterday, after we talked to Charles, and based on the feedback we were seeing in our YouTube live chat, the fact that we started getting emails about 5 minutes after our live stream wrapped, it just didn't make sense for Alberta's government, for the provincial government, to pull its funding, to pull its contribution to Calgary and Edmonton for these public transit protests.
No.
Were you surprised in the least to see the government walk it back day of?
I mean, a little, but not from this government. No, but yeah, so many people pissed off about this yesterday.
Yeah, it was interesting to see where Real Talkers are coming at this from, because we heard from some of you that were saying basically, I'm conservative and this doesn't make sense to me. And those of you that sort of took a bit more of a, well, a flamethrower approach, we might call it, saying that this is sort of been par for the course for this conservative government that you clearly did not support. So we were getting interesting feedback from people that basically just said it's a tough look. I mean, to cut to the chase, it's a tough look to defund stuff that's helping low-income earners and people on fixed income like seniors, right? So EAB writes in, talk at ryanjesperson.com. Now, keep in mind, EAB wrote this email before the policy had been walked back. So you want to read the context, but I think that what he says, or what they say, rather, is important to hear. It says, I occasionally follow the show. I occasionally tune into Real Talk, but this is the first time that I've sent an email. So that's also something, too, man. When an issue prompts somebody to write for the first time.
Occasionally, though?
Yeah, that's something. Yeah, oh, I
Come
know
on.
We should get Niab to listen every single day. Come on, Niab. Come on. But it says, I just learned that the provincial government's pulling support for one of the most popular and effective low-income support programs in the city of Calgary. The Fair Entry Program, which allows low-income families to access transit at a reduced rate and covers the cost of other essential services. There are close to 120,000 people that utilize this program, and the number goes up during tougher economic times. Says it's one thing to play politics with optics and rhetoric, but it's another thing to play with people's lives and livelihoods, especially the lowest income individuals and households that are barely getting by. Yab says, I've seen a lot from this government that raises eyebrows, but this is beyond infuriating. Whoever made this decision has no clue what it means to be a single mom with no vehicle. The only way to get groceries, to go to a medical appointment, is to wait for a bus, even if it's minus 30 degrees. This is obvious, should be, but low-income individuals can't afford to order an Uber every time they have an essential need. This government is throwing vulnerable people under the bus, quite literally out of the bus. And I think that most people that you hear from will find this decision to be irresponsible and reckless. Please consider mentioning this in your show and give a voice to the voiceless. Peace. That from Iab. I love that email. I appreciate that. And how about this from Sandra, who wrote in from the beautiful Alberta community, the central Alberta community of Wetaskiwin. Shout out to Wetaskiwin. Sandra says, I'm really disappointed that the provincial government's decided to end funding for low-income transit passes. Now, keep in mind, the funding's now been restored, okay? She wrote this in like literally 5 minutes after we wrapped our episode. She says, I just can't understand this decision. Is this just another attempt to get back at municipal governments in Edmonton and Calgary because their mayors aren't UCP or Take Back Alberta supporters? Like, is it really because it's a cost-saving measure? It says both of those reasons don't make sense. You know, there are blatant attempts to force municipalities to adopt this party system. It's eroding the democratic process. And I know that once a party's elected, members are going to vote the party line, not necessarily what their constituents want. We've heard some of these concerns represented on Real Talk. Sandra says, I like the fact that our city councilors vote according to what's in the best interest of cities that they're working in. You know, targeting low-income earners in Edmonton and Calgary is just another example of authoritarian rule in Alberta. Sandra says, if this is to save money, why are we spending $9 million on a study for provincial passenger rail service? That's something not a lot of people are talking about. I meant to bring that up on yesterday's episode. Different passenger rail options. Premier says she's really bullish on this. I know some people think that it's a good idea. But when you stack up the two, right, you're going to spend $9 million to look into passenger rail options, and you're going to pull a little bit more than that away from big cities for public transit. Interesting, stacked up against each other, isn't it? Sandra says, you know, this pipe dream of big passenger rail plans will cost billions of dollars, money we don't have. And if you're serious, this government, about building the Heritage Trust Fund, we'll never have it. Why are we wasting millions of dollars here, there, and everywhere, other than making Alberta a laughing stock? Says, you know, she goes into talking about the war room. She says, we got to get rid of this Canadian Energy Center, free up money to help with transit passes. People need supports to get to work, to get to appointments, to get to grocery stores, and they're under attack. She says, I'd like to see this government show that it has some heart and do better. That from Sandra, who wrote in to talk at ryanjesperson.com. You can always tell us what you think about these types of stories. I know that, like, every once in a while, whether or not a policy is actually implemented. So you look at this and you say the government walked it back. The government did the right thing. All things considered, people are going to have the funding restored, so they don't need to worry about it. The maybe not the bigger picture, but the interesting point in the role of talk shows in this is to go, what was the thinking on this? What was the risks that the advisors or the staff or the elected officials were willing to take, and was it worth it? What can we read into this? Sometimes you might just go, well, let's not read too much into it. Maybe this is much ado about nothing, but it's certainly a high profile situation for this government, and one obviously that had a lot of you talking. We're going to get to the top story in Canadian politics as well. Plus, we're hoping to check in with Hamza Hawidi. He's going to be joining us, has a piece in Newsweek, a Palestinian peace activist. Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about what's coming up starting May 9th at Northwest Fest. This is Canada's longest running nonfiction film festival. And this year, I'm so excited that they get the bragging rights as they present the world premiere of The Cigarette Surfboard. This is a rousing tale of an impassioned surfer who created a functional surfboard from 10,000 littered cigarette butts collected from beaches in California. Imagine how disgusting it would be collecting all of those, but how cool it would be to see them turned into a surfboard. Well, little did he know that this would begin a global campaign to hold big tobacco accountable for toxic waste. Now, filmmaker Ben Judkins and surfboard designer Taylor Lane are going to be in attendance at Northwest Fest, and they're going to be bringing some surfboards to the screening. So it's going to be super cool. They're also going to be joining us, by the way, on our Real Talk Roundtable coming up on May 3rd right here on the show. So that's The Cigarette Surfboard at Northwest Fest. You can find more details on their website, including their full lineup of films. That's a great place to get tickets. And if you're a Real Talk patron, check your email this weekend. We've got a special promotion for you to show our appreciation for your support of the show and for supporting Northwest Fest. That's northwestfest.ca. Do you have plans yet to honor Mom for Mother's Day? Do you have plans yet to show up with something that's going to knock her socks off? Our friends at Friesen Brothers have you covered with their Mother's Day charcuterie box. This is one that you can order ahead of time. You can totally customize it. You can pick it up at any of their 17 locations. Just $90. And this is an amazing way to treat Mom for all the things she does, to truly say thank you. They're going to be prepared with the best Alberta deli meats, the best Alberta cheeses, and accoutrement. You can get your order started at cateringbyfriesen.com. We're going to give a shout out to Neil all week long here. Neil, a real talker that wrote into the show after he was experiencing some issues with his business. They had a freezer, like an ice machine type rig, go sideways. It was a big malfunction, and Neil was concerned that his floor was going to get ruined with all this moisture. So he goes to CompleteCareRestoration.ca, just like I'm showing you right here, and he gets the contact information. He remembers us saying that this is a business that takes your issues seriously and treats your property like it's their own. And so he gives him a call. And in less than 24 hours, he's got the owner of the company on site giving him informed advice on how to protect his business investment. Neil wrote in to us and said, I was so impressed with their prompt response, their professionalism, and the thoroughness of their response to my simple request for advice. Way to go. To the team at Complete Care Restoration, we're proud to talk about you anytime. All right, so drama in Ottawa yesterday as the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and the official opposition leader Pierre Poilievre start going at it, start throwing bombs at one another. I mean, trust me, they're in campaign mode, right? You can just feel it. Poilievre's been in campaign mode for a year. And you know that the Prime Minister, as he told us in February when he joined us in the studio, doesn't plan on going anywhere. Doesn't, quite frankly, seem to give a damn about where his polling's at right now. Seems like he's got a plan. Seems like he believes that he's got enough time to attack Poilievre and create a narrative that will erode, you have to assume, that 20-point lead-ish that Poilievre's seeing in the polls. Now, you remember a few days ago, we talked about Pierre Poilievre stopping. Well, he was out with his staff at a roadside sort of an encampment, a demonstration, an axe the tax demonstration, so to speak. And they stopped and he mixed and he mingled and he talked to the folks there. And there were some logos and things like a Diagonalon sticker, you know, that group, that far right group that the RCMP have talked about. You can Google it if you're unfamiliar. And so people started talking about the risks, the political risks that Pierre Poilievre was taking. I mean, was it a risk at all? Or what could ultimately be the cost of stopping and talking to folks like this? I think general consensus is it's no different than some of the other conversations he's had and some of the other people that he's talked to through the trucker convoy and the like. But Justin Trudeau thinks he's on to something. And so in the House of Commons, he leads off with this.
But given the new, more reasonable tone of the Leader of the Opposition, I wonder if he might take this opportunity to reassure Canadians that he does not support extremist white nationalist organizations like Diagonalon, nor wants their votes. Leader of the Opposition refuses to say a simple thing that he condemns Diagonalon because they are a white nationalist violent organization, that he rejects the endorsement of Alex Jones, an extremist conspiracy theorist who denied the deaths of 20 kids at Sandy Hook. These are things that concern Canadians that he should also answer for. If he wants to talk about secret plans, he would probably do well to actually clear the air for Canadians about his seeking for support amongst members of extremist white ring organizations like Diagonalon.
Okay, so Poilievre does not like this at all. You can tell. He gets his back up, and obviously it's also an opportunity, right? Like, the Prime Minister's kind of put this one on a tee for him. And so he fires back.
He continues to allow those drugs to kill the people in our hospitals and on our public transit. When will we put an end to this wacko policy by this wacko Prime Minister?
No. That is not... There are a couple of things which are going on here today, which is not acceptable. And I ask all members, please, to keep themselves, to control themselves. I'm going to ask two things. One, I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition to withdraw that term, which is not considered parliamentary.
Mr. Speaker, I replace wacko with extremist. He is an extremist.
The Honourable Member to please... I'm going to ask the Leader of the Opposition once again to just withdraw that comment, please. And I'll invite the Honourable Member... I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition to please withdraw that comment and simply withdraw that comment.
I'll replace it with radical fascist policy.
I am not asking to replace. I'm asking the Honourable Member to just simply withdraw.
Mr. Speaker, I replace the word wacko with extremist.
I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition one last time to please withdraw that comment and simply withdraw that comment.
I simply withdraw and replace with the aforementioned adjective.
Mr. Poilievre, I have to name you for disregarding the authority of the chair. Pursuant to the authority granted to me by Standing Order 11, I order you to withdraw from the House and from any participation by video conference for the remainder of this day's sitting.
Okay, so this is this week in the House of Commons. This is the back and forth. So drug policy is where Poilievre wants to go on this. But the word wacko, you have to assume is sort of where this turns the tide, this wacko prime minister, right? And so then the speaker leverages, I guess, essentially his role, trying to, what do you want to say, preserve reintroduce decorum into the House. And as you heard on three different occasions, says, you know, please withdraw, please apologize. And Poilievre says no. So he gets kicked out. Now, number one, we've seen this in past with like managers of baseball teams, coaches of hockey teams, maybe even players in some sports that get kicked out on purpose. So part of me wonders if this is Poilievre digging in his heels to make this a bigger thing. Mm-hmm. The grandstanding, getting kicked out, not the worst. It's not like he's being docked pay. it's not like he's serving 48 hours in jail.
No.
So he gets kicked out. It becomes a bigger story, and then he can pursue the narrative that he's being silenced.
Of course.
Right? So that's what he does, and that's what Poilievre supporters start saying. They start saying that Poilievre is being silenced. And so that's when Mark Miller chimes in, right? Mark Miller, the Minister of the Crown for Indigenous Relations, who's asked by her, well, whatever, you'll hear it yourself. So there's a reporter question and then a real zinger from Miller.
Do you think what happened today is going to fuel the narrative that he's being silenced by the Liberals?
Who's being silenced?
Pierre.
That guy's never shut his mouth in his life. Who silences him? He keeps saying dumb things. I think it would be good if he shut up. He shut his yap once in a while. But the stuff that he does in the House of Commons is disgraceful. But he plays on that. He's a guy that likes to play outside the lines. When someone steps out the lines to confront him, he freezes.
So that's Mark Miller. Says the guy's never shut up a day in his life. I don't know if it's believable that Pierre Poilievre is being silenced, but the question is, should he have been kicked out of the House of Commons? Now, the request from the Conservatives, they want to see Greg Fergus, they want to see the Speaker resign. He says he's not going anywhere. And personally, I don't believe he should go anywhere. I do think that we need somebody taking a stand at some point. Don't you agree? I mean, if you look at the common theme of what people have been saying in the chat, the concerns around introducing, there's always these common threads in the stories we talk about, introducing partisan politics to the municipal level. Now, there are concerns around lobbying and who holds the power and where the money's going to go and who's going to be making the decisions in whose best interest. But what's another one of the recurring themes? It's the tone that people are concerned about. It's the fighting. It's the flag planting and the team sport negativity that people are concerned about the introduction of. And that's this, I think, on display. Now, the question is, are Canadians better or worse off when politics goes in this direction?
I know so.
Some people love this stuff, well, the theater of politics.
It's the way of the world today. People love the drama. They love the zingers. They love the one-liners. And Pierre knows exactly what he's doing. He's getting a nice clip, which, what do you know? We're playing on our show today. That's yeah. exactly what he's doing. And even if he gets kicked out for a day, like you said, he doesn't get docked pay. He's back the next
yeah.
day. It's nothing, no skin off his back.
If I'm Poilievre, I love that I got kicked out.
Of course.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
He might have even been
pushing
for that.
Yeah, right? So. Exactly. Yeah, it may have been exactly what he was going for, what he was looking for.
Yeah.
Through this. So. You know, you can let us know what you think about this. I mean, I know that this kind of, you know, Trudeau's been very clear about, I think, indicating where he thinks he can attack Poilievre. We certainly, it was an interesting one to hear Poilievre touching on the drug crisis in BC.
Yeah.
Now there's some different ways you can approach talking about the tragedy that is. And you hear, you know, Poilievre in the longer clips talking about how 2,500 drug deaths in British Columbia. He's putting this mm-hmm. on the Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people that need to take the opioid crisis more seriously. I'm not sure that it has everything to do with federal drug policy, liberal drug policy. It probably doesn't have everything to do with BC's provincial policy, but there's obviously been problems there. And that's something that we're going to take a look at in more fulsome fashion. Again, coming up on the May 8th episode of Real Talk. On the live chat here, Elizabeth says, I think that it was a disgusting move to kick Pierre Poilievre out of the House, as Trudeau was acting much more dangerously. That from Elizabeth. Says, I do think that the Speaker of the House should be removed and replaced, whether that's a resignation or otherwise. Kenzie says, yeah, listen to the Speaker, like an ineffective parent. Well, I don't know about that. And then others of you are saying that this has, you know, Jesperson's got to stop feeding the trolls here. This is all theater and has no value. I don't disagree with you that it's all theater. The question of whether or not it has value, I don't know. I mean, am I stretching too far? Am I going to pull my hamstring to suggest that stuff like this, that's a little more sensational, a little bit more attention grabbing, that's a little bit more intriguing, or dare I even say entertaining, that puts politics back on people's radar, that reminds people what's happening in question period, that puts politics on the average person's level where they can see it even for 30 seconds? Is that maybe a good thing?
In their plane. You know what comes to mind when I see this stuff happening? That this is all Conor McGregor's fault.
Conor McGregor.
it's like a warm-up for a fight, and that's exactly what Pierre and Trudeau are doing right now. Pierre more so, more harshly all the time. But it's like all this bickering and barking and all this stuff leading up to an election that is looming, right? And it's getting in the zingers, getting, you know, ferocious, getting heated to the point that you get kicked out. And as for the speaker, the guy's just a moderator. He's like the guy watching the YouTube chat, right? He's just trying to keep expletives and insults out of the house, and that's his only, that's his main function, is to be a moderator, and that's what he's doing. So
if you ever meet somebody in your life whose job is to moderate a YouTube chat,
it sucks.
You buy him lunch every once in a while. You buy him lunch. Yeah. Although our YouTube chat is more civilized than most, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I mean, even the people, there's Poilievre supporters, there's Trudeau supporters. I mean, it doesn't even feel like Trudeau supporters. It feels like there's those that are supporting Poilievre and there's those that are opposing Poilievre. I don't see anybody in here like clapping for the prime minister. But Seventh Pilot says, you know, the word wacko was changed to extremist. Poilievre was still kicked out. He withdrew the term, then had to remove the comment. Fergus was out of line. Chris Clymer says, come on, Jespo, this is basically fake. This is nothing. Poilievre was challenging Trudeau on his policy regarding drugs, and all Trudeau did was go on a tangent, as he does, and would not answer the questions. And then there's a bunch of you talking about the rail thing. I know we're bouncing around today. We said we were going to do it. But this, in the context, of course, of the bigger picture, the Alberta government announcing that they're going to look into investing in passenger rail. Is that
Thank
something
you.
On the other side of this? Is that something you might be? Can you see yourself using more trains? You think?
I am taking a lot of public transit.
Yeah, you but are taking a lot.
Trains
of
are the ones
transit.
I hate. It's the one when I'm on Gateway and I look to the right and I'm like, they still.
But
got
we're
that
talking
rail
now,
line
like
there.
We're talking now, like high speed rail, Calgary to Edmonton. We're talking what I think their first.
Oh,
I think their
monorail,
first
monorail.
Monorail.
Monorail. I'm into that.
I think the first one they would do, and I have nothing to base this on, this is just a gut instinct, I think the first one they would do would be Calgary to Banff.
Yeah, it'd be perfect.
That's a no-brainer.
Yeah, it's great.
And then if you can, I don't know how you would do it, but if you can
Calgary
do like do something cool, Calgary to Edmonton,
yeah.
Maybe you do something like, I mean, is there potential for something between Grand Prairie and Fort McMurray?
Yeah.
Is there a way to better tie together Jasper and Banff in a way that's maybe existing, utilizing. I mean, I'm not the expert, but.
Yeah. How good would that be, though, to just take a nap and be in Calgary?
Be unreal, man.
In like, you know,
it's like the
less
next,
than an
the
hour.
Next gen Red Arrow.
It'd be amazing.
Because right? I always see all these people that fly from Calgary to Edmonton. And I know that there are commuters, mostly, you know, for business, I would imagine. But for me, it's just never made sense. It's like once you go to the airport, you get your parking, you go through
Cheryl
security,
Oates does
you
this,
wait
like,
to get,
once a
right?
month. And I'm like, what's the point?
Co-host of The Discourse, new
you
episode.
Drive in the same time it takes to go
literally
there an hour before, get through security, get on the flight.
And then you're at the airport, then you got to figure out your... forget about it. Forget about it. Not for me. But high-speed rail between the two, downtown core to downtown core, I'd be listening. Yeah. Question is the juice worth the squeeze? Yeah. Is it worth the dough?
Thank you, Kenzie, for the $5 super chat.
Oh, really? Kenzie. Shout out to Kenzie for the $5. Thanks. Is there a message attached? Okay, I don't know. Kenzie, thanks very much. We appreciate you. We appreciate everybody that supports the show. And that includes our amazing partners, like our friends at Kubi Renewable Energy, who have a pretty simple message right now, and that is as the ice and snow have now cleared, their teams are getting up on roofs. Their teams are starting to put these plans into action. They've been designing these solar installations through the winter months, and now their teams of installers, now that can be apprentices, it can be folks with their tickets, right? The journey persons in the provinces of BC and Alberta are getting to work because Kubi is going to install more solar in Western Canada this year than anybody else. And that means that they're hiring. And not just those of you that want to get up on the roof, although if that is you, they want to talk to you. They're looking for designers. They're looking for salespeople. They're looking for office managers. Lethbridge, Kamloops, Calgary, Edmonton, you name it, Kubi's there. BC and Alberta, helping Canada achieve its sustainable energy goals, if you want to be part of that movement, if you want to drive sustainable energy forward in Canada and get paid for it, check out the careers link today at kubienergy.ca. I love when you show us that video of that fire hall. That's Canada's first net
looks like
zero
a
fire hall.
Skateboard ramp or something.
I know it does. Oh, that's all I can think about now. How cool is that? That was all done by the team at Kubi. Shout out to them. And then there's our friends that do remarkable design and installation work inside people's homes and offices. And that's California Closets. Custom storage and closet solutions for your entire home. The best part about the kickoff to working with California Closets is that it doesn't cost you a thing to sit down with their consultants, sit down with their designers, and see what ideas they might have to help you get organized, to help you declutter. They can custom design any solution to fit your space and your budget. Their expert design consultants collaborate with you to create a personalized solution based on your style, your needs, and your budget. You can learn more and book your design consultation today by visiting californiaclosets.ca. And all this talk about emissions, the talk about the oil sands. We spent a lot of time talking about energy over the past number of weeks. We want to make sure that you've had a chance to check out Pathways Alliance. Pathways Alliance is working with governments on a proposed carbon capture and storage network for Canada's oil sands. Global energy demands are changing, of course. That's why Canada's six largest oil sands companies are working together to offer the world responsibly produced oil. Pathways Alliance will build that large-scale carbon capture and storage network to reduce emissions from operations, and they're doing it in a way that they believe will protect existing jobs and create new ones. Responsibly produced energy is what the world wants. It's what Alberta can provide. You can learn more about the how by visiting pathwaysalliance.ca.
Monorail.
It'd be interesting to see a government step up, and I mean a provincial government. I think that you would probably have a relatively easy time, and I don't by easy. Let me mm-hmm. choose a different word, but I think that it would be easy to get the feds interested in a funding partnership on something like high speed rail between Calgary and Edmonton.
Sure.
But people have been talking about this for like 30 years.
So long, all over North
since
America.
Since Ralph Klein was premier, people were talking about it, and there doesn't seem to have been a real appetite for it to this point.
No.
I think maybe the cost is probably
of course, a
big reason,
right?
What do you think? It would just probably run right in between the lanes on the QE2, I would imagine.
But I guarantee the cost of it, when somebody said the number, wherever they announced it, there would be people throwing their arms up in the air immediately.
Well, I mean, the question is just like, would people use it? Right. Like that's ultimately what it comes down to. So I don't know, like if you say, well, it's going to be, and I'm making up the number. Okay. You know, I mean, people in the chat are saying like rail long term is a great idea. One engine instead of hundreds of cars.
Sure.
You know, some of you are pointing out that other jurisdictions around the world, obviously, I mean, if you ever traveled Europe, you know this. That's one example of many. I mean, look at in Asia. Look at how Japan is celebrated for its train system.
Sure.
Right. I mean, like the Japanese trains. If you ever had a friend of ours just visited Japan with his family, and he was posting videos on these trains that are going like 300 kilometers an hour in an efficient system that is always on time and everybody uses it, then I think it's a no-brainer, especially as populations increase, right? And road congestion increases, and you're looking about, you know, things like emissions and all that kind of stuff is on people's radar. Maybe the conversation gets more serious this time around. I don't know. It'd create a lot of jobs. That's something that'll catch a government's attention too, right?
Like sure.
Building this rail network out would create a lot of jobs, I should say. You know what we'll do? Why don't we'll put out an unofficial, unscientific Twitter poll, and we'll give you a few different options on where the rail lines would go. I'll do it in the next few minutes. So what do you think? Calgary to Banff, we'll put one on there.
That'd be for sure.
You know, Calgary to Edmonton, I think, is an obvious one.
I like the something to Fort McMurray would make sense.
Yeah. So maybe you do it like, I mean, I don't know if Lethbridge gets included in this, but maybe you do something like Lethbridge to Calgary to Red Deer to Edmonton to Fort McMurray, right? Like maybe there's that line that kind of goes up through the province.
Are you trying to say all the oil workers would be giving up their trucks and riding monorails?
Well, but how many? But how many oil workers and how many seasonal or shift workers, contract workers,
construction workers,
like
whatever.
Either taking buses they or flying or they're on the highways all the time? Yeah. We know that is it 63 off the top of my head? It's Highway 63, the one that they were fighting to twin that highway for ages and ages because of all the fatalities on there and just the brutal travel on those highways in particular in the winter months, but not limited to the winter.
That's
right?
Exactly what I thought when you brought this up is the winter. They would just be packed. People would take it all the time. You'd avoid all the traffic. When we talked about this the other day, even where I live getting to work, it's just gridlock in the winter. So to take a monorail or a hyperloop, as Elon Musk calls it, whatever, a high speed train from here to Calgary in January, February, when it's crazy snow, that'd be perfect.
Yeah. Tracy says rail's great, but it is a want, not a need, unless, of course, the private sector is completely picking up the tab. I don't know that you get the private sector to 100% fund something like this, right? You always look at how governments work here, and they'll come up with the deals. Look at the subsidies. You see them a lot in Ontario. I'm not trying to go off on a tangent here. But in trying to attract that business and in trying to attract operators, typically governments will have to step up and say, we'll fund or at least fund the lion's share or a significant part of that infrastructure. I don't think that this rail line gets built 100% privately. Would there be an appetite in the first place? This is what the provincial government's looking into. We wanted to revisit. Did you have something to say?
No, I just said M. Aiken in the chat saying, it's not feasible, Johnny. We're just dreaming here. We're just thinking, okay, M?
Is it not feasible, though? I mean, is that, like, from a cost standpoint, because that's when it comes down to it. And let's also say, you know, we're talking about, it's not lost on us that we're talking about public transit a lot as well. We're talking about public transit in particular in Calgary and Edmonton, funding and programs, that pilot program for seniors and low income earners. Well, if you are looking to public transit anywhere, and as I'm not a professor and I've not done the research here, and so maybe somebody can prove me wrong here, but I'm not sure, maybe there is, but I'm not sure of a public transit, of a profitable public transit service anywhere in the world. I mean, maybe it exists, but transit is a, and I know, you know, this word, like it's an expense, it's a cost. Now people will say I should use the word investment. It's an investment into a jurisdiction, into a municipality or what have you. But you don't have, like it costs taxpayers to run buses and run trains, and they try to recover some of those costs with transit fares. Yeah. But you're never profiting off of public transit. I don't think that happens anywhere.
That's why when you brought it up, it would have to coincide with getting workers around to do jobs, to build infrastructure. But Dwayne makes a good point here too, like $30 billion debt right now in infrastructure already. So like I was saying, for somebody to get on the news or get in a press conference and say, hey, we're going to spend another X amount of dollars on, like you said, this very efficient public transit that is probably not going to make a lot of money. Yeah, it isn't feasible. Okay, M. Aiken, we're just chatting though. We're dreaming.
Tracy says cost benefit analysis can be done by comparing, you know, against train and bus service. The question is who would use it? How many people are out there that would? It says buses stopped for the most part due to low usage, and you're not wrong. How much did that? I hate bringing it up because it's just one of the worst stories of all time. But that beheading on the bus in Manitoba, right?
Yeah.
How much did that have to do, do you think, with the collapse? I understand this is more like a question you would ask over beers or around a campfire because we don't have statistics in front of us. But I just think after that high profile killing, that horrific killing where that young man had his life just snuffed out. By this individual now who, by the way, is walking free with a different name, walking free. But how much did that, do you think, hurt the reputation of and ultimately the revenues of bus service in the country? I bet more than people think.
Oh, huge. I mean, we were talking about this on the show the other day, even with the crime here in Alberta and the problems with addiction and the problems with houselessness that are kind of leaking into the transit system right now. You said it yourself the other day when we were talking about transit and I was singing its praises. You said, I'd never take my son on public transit right now. I just wouldn't do it. You know,
I felt bad
mean?
After I said that because I have taken him on public
transit.
Yeah,
and we can
before.
Talk more about that. To, like to... you take him to a hockey game.
Sure.
20,000 intoxicated people flooding in out into the city where you're going to see houselessness, addiction on the streets. You're probably taking the same risk or maybe even more than 20, 40 people on a bus or a train car. But I get what you're saying. People don't feel... you know, confident right now taking public transit, and for sure that beheading. I mean, would you even go near public transit after that?
Well, I don't know. It would just always be in the back of my, I mean, it's like September 11th was the same thing for air travel where all of a sudden, like
nobody
you
flew.
Know, if you look at like security, I mean, I know I'm saying the most obvious thing of all time here, but like, if you look at the changes in security, you know, post 9/11, mm-hmm. it's hard to imagine how easy it was to get weapons and whatever else mm-hmm. onto planes before. And so I think you just start thinking about a Greyhound or, you know, whatever bus.
Yeah.
And after something like that happens, and you just, you're like, you picture yourself in a scenario, like what would I do in a constricted metal tube if all of a sudden somebody, and I'm absolutely not making light of it. If somebody was experiencing a mental health episode or was on some, you know, on meth or like whatever and had weapons and started whatever, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And people start asking that question, what would I do? And let alone, could I nod off and fall asleep? Mm-hmm. And people will say, listen, dude, millions of people traveled on buses and this one incident happens and whatever. But all I know is that there was that high profile situation. And then all of a sudden for the next 10 years, anytime that public bus service in mm-hmm. particular, like rural or interprovincial bus travel came up in conversation,
sure.
people would reference the beheading.
I'm giggling right now too, and I'm not making light of it, but I was just thinking of, I always know when I'm watching a pre-2001 television show or movie, because you see people like, you know, just showing their ticket, no ID.
Just walking on the plane.
Friends and relatives running to the gates and saying goodbye to them or right up to the door. Things have changed so much since 9/11. Yeah. It's absolutely insane.
Isn't it wild to think?
It's crazy.
Dwayne makes a good point in our YouTube live chat, says, remember when that bus driver was so badly beaten in Edmonton?
Oh, yeah.
I sure do. That was Tom Bragg is his name. I had a chance to interview Tom Bragg after the fact. The guy lost an eye, sustained serious brain damage and life-changing physical injuries as a result of that horrific beating, dragged out of the bus and beaten because he was insisting that the person trying to board the bus pay the fare.
Mm-hmm.
And like honestly, again, and I'm heaping on to stigma here, but you know what else? You could not pay me enough to drive public transit, and the people that do and the amount of BS that they put up with, they deserve it. You start talking about where municipal budgets are right now and property taxes, so you got to, when you start talking about who deserves raises, you realize a lot of people deserve a raise, but I think public transit drivers deal with so much more than what their pay would indicate they should be dealing with.
Every time I get off a bus, I yell from the back, thank you. Because I know it's a thankless job for the most part. The other thing is, though, I've noticed this, like you just said, I see kids, I see people who, you know, appear houseless, getting on public transit all the time when I'm on it in the morning and in the afternoon on the way home, not paying, and the bus drivers do not even give it a second glance now.
Number one,
they just, whatever.
They shouldn't.
Yeah.
Like, number one, whatever.
Yeah.
And number two, I believe that that's a directive. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they're supposed to get into it anymore. Hey, and I want to say that in our chat as well. Where did it go? Is it Crystal? We hear you, Crystal. She left a comment here too. Yeah, it's Crystal. She says, I worry that this though is fear mongering about transit. Transit is the only option to get around the city for hundreds of thousands of people. And Crystal, I hear you, and I know, and that's why, like, when I said, and it was a few shows ago, something, I made this kind of glib comment where I was like, I'm not taking my kid on public transit.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, to be honest with you, as soon as it was out of my mouth, I was kind of like, I don't like that look, because number one, I have taken my kid on public transit. And number two, what a sort of a privileged comment to make. And number three, I take Crystal's point. And what's one way to make transit more safe is to get more people riding it. Mm-hmm. And so there's that too. And I don't just want to be part of the problem.
No, not at all. And when you said that, I thought back to one of the instances I remember the most is when I first started taking public transit about 5 months ago to and from work. On the way home from work, I saw an entire family and young. These kids looked like 21, 22, three kids. One had to be like six. One had to be like four, because you know, one was sitting, one was standing, and then a baby in a carriage. So all three of those kids and a mother and a father on a bus.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is what public transit is for. And, you know, I don't think that family thinks, is it safe or not? They just think we got to get, you know, wherever, we got to pick up our kids, we got to get home, we got to get groceries. They had a couple bags with them. They probably just went to, you know, Freezing Bros or wherever they shop, right?
So good call.
Yeah. Some people, it's just, they have to.
I want to give the mic, I want to give the conch to Egg in our live chat. Egg says, transit's fine. Get out of your cars and your suburbs. This is fear-mongering nonsense from suburban scaredy cats. Oh, public transit is scary, says the person who doesn't use it. This is absolutely ridiculous. That from Egg. And I'll take your point. It's a fair point. I think that you would have a difficult time convincing everybody that public transit is pristine, but I do agree that I'm being a little bit selective right now, aren't I, with the headlines that I'm invoking. Mm-hmm. But we've seen the stories, like people stabbed on transit, people bear sprayed on transit, yeah, people pushed down the concrete steps at transit stations, seniors, women, elderly people, mm-hmm, beaten, you know, like innocent people minding their own business on their way to work or on their way about their day and being beaten mercilessly at transit stations. Now, those are real situations off the top of my head. If you Google them, you'll see them. And I am only referencing situations in our home city and off the top of my head, the last 12 months. So you may say, okay, Jesperson, you've named 3 to 5 scenarios, 3 to 5 stories out of the how many millions of riders every mm-hmm single year. And you would be right. But those are the types of situations where I think, like, do I want my 8-year-old with me walking into a scenario in a transit station where something's going down and all of a sudden I've put him in that position? Mm-hmm. But I'm not a scaredy cat. I'm not a person that doesn't believe that my children need to be sheltered from everything and can't see people from different walks of life than them. Absolutely not.
You don't want to.
So I'll take Egg's point.
You don't want to take the risk. I get it. Because you have a kid and, you know, I'm not a parent. I don't know what that's like, but I imagine you want to protect them at all costs. That is your job. But I will say that all the times I've rode transit, I haven't seen any of these things you're talking about. I've never seen a fight, a stabbing. Occasionally someone's loud or intoxicated, depending on the time of day. Occasionally, like, some kids are annoying and on their phones, or somebody with one of those speakers on their back. People walk around with these speakers playing music. I've never seen these incidences of violence, but I do understand that they exist and they happen. But honestly, I feel more uncomfortable at, like, the gym with the aggro guys lifting the weights and screaming than I do on public transit. But I get where you're coming from. I know there's some parents out there. There's some people who are just like, I'm not going to do it right now. And that's you know, reflected because of the crime and the issues we have in the city right now.
We're by sort of extending this chat, I'm just reflecting where the audience is on this. This is awesome. And we just so appreciate our live chat every single morning. Those of you that join us on the Mixler live audio app presented by California Closets and on YouTube. Steven says, Jespo, you're singling in on isolated events from a long time ago. Some of you are talking about the role that media plays in all of this. Ken makes a fair point. Ken says, I'd be hesitant to talk about extreme cases of schizophrenia with tragic results like that bus incident in Manitoba. They are rare, they are terrible, and they are a result of extreme mental disease. Ken, I 100% agree. Mm-hmm. I 100% agree. My question is just, to what degree do you think that incident, that tragedy, hurt Greyhound or hurt that method of transport across Canada? Like, it may be sort of like, you know, this whole, like, correlation causation debate, and maybe it had nothing to do with it. I'd have a hard time believing that. But I don't think it had everything to do with it. I think there were other market factors at play. I also want to note, and we won't have your names just because there's so many comments right now. It's like watching a stock ticker. I love it. But many of you bringing it back to, like, high-speed passenger rail and in particular the link between Calgary and Edmonton are talking about the economic benefit of it. You know, one of you saying in theory you could live in one city and work in the other, you know, which is obviously a great point to make. Egg chiming back in says all transit stations should be staffed, and the underfunding is where we see a lot of safety issues. For sure. But, like, again, you want to talk about property taxes and operating expenses and how much we already pay for the police. And if you're not talking about having cops there, if you're talking about having sheriffs or bylaw officers or transit security officers, and certainly we're seeing those roles expanded, aren't we? I mean, we've heard that from the premier. We've heard it from the public safety minister. You're talking about added cost. And so then we can have that conversation as well. I want to go back to March 21st when Andrea Hines joined us. Andrea owned and operated a brothel. She sold sex for a number of years, as she tells us in the interview. You can find it in our archives. We're going to link to it directly in our show notes. But her life journey is nothing short of remarkable. She's just released a book alongside co-author Kathy King, When Men Buy Sex, Who Really Pays? Canadian Stories of Exploitation, Survival, and Advocacy. She now describes herself as a sex trade abolitionist, and she's calling for reform to law across Canada. You can get the full sense of where her perspective is at and how she arrived there by listening to the full interview, but here's a portion of our conversation with Andrea Hines back on March 21st.
A lot of danger, a lot of risk, you know, where they're asking women to swallow ejaculate, where they're, you know, asking women to have sex, you know, sexual intercourse without condoms. Women are, you know, desperate for the money, and we're seeing this slippery slope of where these things didn't used to happen. When I was in the industry, you didn't even kiss a sex buyer. You never gave a blowjob without a condom. Now that is almost unheard of. And if you are one of those people, you're very, very unlikely to be making any money. Now what we're seeing is this explosion of girlfriend experience, or GFE, which is, again, you know, kissing, intimacy. Like, so it's not even just the physical act, but now it's the emotional. You have to, you know, give yourself and your spirit to this person, not just your body. And then that went by the wayside, and now we're in PSE, which is porn star experience. And that basically is, you know, what we were talking about with porn. Like, anything goes, you know, you can find any video of anything. And now, as long as you have about $400, you can go into a City of Edmonton brothel. You can request that a woman has bareback sex with you. And these women are taking antiviral, like anti-HIV medication after the fact, just to avoid, you know, any like personal risk to some degree. And, you know, obviously of a physical nature. And just doing that for the money, right? Because that's the only way that they can make money, some of these women. So, like, when do we stop and kind of say enough is enough? Like, we want more for women. You know, women deserve better. I don't fault anybody who's in the industry. I don't shame women. I don't think, like, you know, bad you, you're a fallen woman or anything like that. Like, I think that they are, you know, captured. They are ideologically captured, like many of us are, right? Men and women who are involved in this. And when people actually remove themselves out of the sex industry, they always say the same thing to me. One, I had no idea. And two, my life is so much better now.
Yeah, so interesting stuff. Real talk from Andrea Hines. And it prompted a lot of response, even right now in the live chat. I know not everybody agreed with how she comes at this or the position she takes on it. A correction, by the way, that was March 19th, the episode she joined us. It prompted an email from Ian that I wanted to read, and then we'll get to Cheryl's. Ian says, I just wanted to write in to give some props for such an interesting interview with Andrea Hines. Says, I thought it was a masterclass in bringing a sensitive and ancient topic to the fore. And it didn't hurt that Ms. Hines is extremely well-spoken, the kind of person we need in the political arena, maybe. Ian says, at any rate, I came away better informed and thinking of these issues in a new light, which is clearly the point of Real Talk. So bravo, Ian says. But it is curious how regressive her position is. He says, and I don't necessarily mean it in a bad way. He says, you were right on to connect the dots to the general trend in Canadian society of increased openness to things that were one-time sins. I'll jump in here, interject. Basically, I talked to Andrea. I said, you're looking to pull back laws. You're basically looking to sort of, you know, to crack down, to clamp down on the world's oldest profession. This, as drugs are being decriminalized, legalized, et cetera, et cetera. Back to Ian's email. He says, I suppose that this position, the openness to these things, one-time sins, has now been called progressive. Now, personally, despite having been an advocate for the broad decriminalization of all things we're now living with, maybe I, like many others, am starting to see things differently. You know, the challenge inherent in addressing the demand side of prostitution is its inherent impossibility, or at least its long-term aspiration. Changing behaviors, which are, at least in part, driven by male biological impulse, is a noble goal, but one without much significant precedent in human society. And of course, you also can't ignore that for some or many men, access to sex outside of paid arrangements is difficult and probably has some real social benefit. Maybe the only reasonable approach is to amp up the protection of children and young women caught up in these various parts of the so-called business, including supportive and sufficiently funded social programs. He says, and probably I should read her book. At any rate, kudos to the show for facilitating a thoughtful conversation that pushed human understanding forward amongst your real talkers. That from Ian. We sure appreciate that. And this one from Cheryl. Cheryl says that there are going to be topics here that would be difficult for some people to hear about. Please, she says, please let your audience know that if you're triggered by topics like sexual abuse or drug and alcohol addiction, what's coming? She says, I tuned into Andrea Heintz on Real Talk discussing the sex trade. And after that, I reached out to her co-author, Kathy King, of the book, When Men Buy Sex, Who Really Pays? I didn't want to talk about the sex trade, although these conversations are important. And I'm beyond impressed that Real Talk created space on the show for such incredibly meaning discourse. But I wanted to talk about our daughters, says Cheryl. Kathy lost her daughter, Kara, in 1997, and she's used her grief to help others with daughters who may be living at-risk lifestyles. Now, why does that matter to me? Because I have a daughter that I haven't seen since last September. Grace was a grade 12 student at an Edmonton high school in 2021, a top student, an athlete, well-liked by her peers and teachers. She started dating a boy from the same high school, her first boyfriend. We often dropped her off at his place in a nice neighborhood with nice parents who were well-educated, good careers. What we didn't know was that this boy, this man, 6'5", was grooming Grace, gaslighting her, whittling away at her self-esteem, finding chinks in her well-being, creating an emotionally abusive relationship where she started to question herself and accept his toxic version of her. And eventually, the emotional abuse turned to sexual assaults. I don't know much about what happened, except for that she always said no, and he never stopped. On Valentine's Day of Grace's graduating year, the boy broke up with her, and it took her months after to tell us what he'd done. She was a smart girl from a family who had talked about these risks with sisters and parents who care for her. She knew better. She was ashamed. And what my husband did when he found out is a story for another day. It's enough to say that the boy's parents know. In order to mask her pain that year, Grace started drinking and taking drugs with some of the boy's friends. We had no idea what was happening. Grace would say she was sleeping over at her friend's place. We'd drop her off, meet the mom, ask if she was going to be there. We would be reassured and we would head home. We didn't know that mom was going through a divorce and drinking herself into a stupor every night, leaving the kids to do whatever they wanted without any supervision. I later learned that my own daughter overdosed twice, at least, during those months. She didn't die because her so-called friend had a naloxone kit and administered that treatment to save Grace's life. Nobody called us. We'd pick her up the next day and everyone would smile and wave as though my daughter's life meant nothing, like they were congratulating themselves for being sneaky and getting away with it. Whose life is a game? Wonders Cheryl. Grace didn't want to report the sexual assaults. She was afraid of the social cost. Her sisters went to battle for her, warning others that hung out with the boy. The claims were dismissed. Nobody wanted to get involved. In fact, most of the peers seemed to side with him. Grace graduated high school with honors, multiple scholarships to various universities. Instead, she deferred studies to take a gap year. It seemed strange to us, but we supported her needing a mental health break before diving into university. It took Grace until the following February before her addiction spiraled to a level where she knew she would die if she didn't stop. She was primarily addicted to drinks and edibles in combination with hard liquor. She knew she had a problem after a trip to Cuba with me where she spent the last half of the five-star trip holed up in our hotel room because of withdrawal symptoms. I didn't know she was suffering from addiction, withdrawal, but she would wake me every night with screaming nightmares that sounded like she was reliving assaults. Without the drugs and alcohol, she couldn't turn off the trauma. Sobriety was insufferable. A couple months after Grace disclosed her addiction, she found and entered a 12-step recovery program and got a sponsor, a sex worker. I was never concerned about the sponsor's career choice. She was 8 years recovered from cocaine, and her service was literally saving my daughter's life. But I did see Grace romanticizing the occupation. We said nothing. This is not our journey. Grace is now an adult, and she needed to figure out her own sober journey. And so in May, she decided to try Tinder, dating only females now. She's lonely. Her sponsor said it was too soon, but Grace wanted what she wanted. The first date went well. The second date, she was violently assaulted. She tried to fight off the girl, but she couldn't. I was sitting up at 2 in the morning when she came in. She said nothing, went to bed, and told me the next morning she had injuries. She was bleeding, but didn't want to go to the police nor the hospital. So we honored that. In June, Grace abruptly moved out. She got an apartment downtown and found work that paid a little bit more than minimum wage. She was going to therapy for the trauma, but university would wait for another year. September 21st, says Cheryl, is the last time I spoke with my daughter. She stopped contact with me and her dad after that. Contact with her sisters has been sporadic. They're struggling with instability in their relationship with her. She's unreliable. She'll disappear for weeks without answering their texts. I don't ask the girls for updates. I worry if I do and Grace finds out, she'll cut off contact from them. We think she still has the same job. I've heard she's enrolled at university for this upcoming fall. Her 20th birthday, a few weeks ago, I heard her sisters got together. Maybe she's fine. Maybe she's back on drugs. I've wondered if she's working in the sex trade. We don't know. I don't try to know. There's no sanity in chasing the unknown. Now, what does this have to do with the sex trade and Andrea Hintz and Real Talk? I'm not sure, but I think a lot about it since Grace left home and is trying to make it on her own while early in recovery from addiction. How does a girl make ends meet if she has had a drug problem and no supports? Usually or often, she sells her body. I have to accept that Grace might do that. And being intelligent, she might convince herself that she's making empowered, not desperate or trauma-based choices. Recently, my husband and I have been helping an organization deliver supply to unhoused people living in the River Valley. And every woman that emerges from a tent to accept water and harm reduction, I wonder about their story. Who harmed them? When did they turn to addiction? Were they once a brilliant child with a bright future? Who prays for them and hopes they're okay? So I reached out to Kathy King. How do I help? Who helped you? And she answered me. And she told me that there aren't answers, just strategies to not let our children's pain consume us. She shared how there's a lot of empowerment talk around the sex trade, glamorizing choice in careers where harm is expected and protection is denied. These little girls had dreams like all of us. They didn't enter the trade because they are self-empowered. They're selling their bodies because their bodies were objectified and commodified by others intent on profiting off their own unfettered impulses. Do I judge the sex worker? Hell no. I judge those who made this beautiful boy or girl think they didn't deserve a choice and safety. Cheryl says, thanks in advance for letting me share. That's one of the most amazing emails we've ever received.
That is incredible. Right? Yeah.
You know, I've been sitting on this, right? I feel like I've read this 10 times, but it just reiterated to me that every time that we're talking to somebody on this show about something serious, about something meaningful, we know that it's resonating with many of you. We feel, I have a strong feeling that every once in a while we do an episode that thousands of people will hear, but it's really for that one person. It's for that one person that needed to hear it. And in this case, I'm so grateful that Cheryl not only took the time to check out the episode and to pour out her thoughts and tell us about her lived experience, but also had the willingness to do it so that this audience can benefit from her understanding, her lived experience, that we can deepen our understanding of those issues. Talk@RyanJesperson.com is where you can send us an email. I'm going to respond to Cheryl personally and let her know how much we appreciate her sharing. Coming up on Friday's Real Talk, that's going to be the 3rd of May, we're going to welcome in filmmakers. A couple of them will join us remotely from California, and then we'll have a panel here in studio. All of this leading up to Northwest Fest. This is Canada's longest-running nonfiction film festival. You can learn more at northwestfest.ca. And don't forget to join us. Plus, you can expect a rowdy edition of The Flamethrower presented by the DQs of Northwest Edmonton and Sherwood Park. We'll see you soon.
Real Talk is hosted by Ryan Jesperson. Executive producer, Josh Dunford. Technical producer, John Hicks. General manager, Katie Cook-Chivers. Account coordinator, Lawrence Derlego. Human resources, Lena Shepherd. Website design, Mike Johnston. Voiceover by me, Carrie Skelton. Real Talk's editorial board is Supriya Duvetti, Ahmed Ali, Brandy Morin, Ann Castleman, Corey Hogan, Harmon Candola, Catherine O'Neill, and Chris Henderson. Member Emerita, Julie Rohr.
Real Talk is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, on Treaty 6 territory, the traditional and ancestral territory of the Cree, Dene, Blackfoot, Soto, and Nakota Sioux, home to the Métis settlements and the Métis Nation of Alberta. Real Talk is a Relay project. For more, check out ryanjesperson.com.